laughter in her voice.
All right, I say. Father has always taught me to be polite to the monks and nuns. We may not follow the Buddhist teachings, but it doesn't make sense to antagonize the spirits, whether they are Taoist, Buddhist, or wild spirits who rely on no learned masters at all. Tell me which flowers you want. I'll try to get them for you without touching them.
She points to some flowers at the end of a slim branch below my bough. They are paler in color than the flowers from the rest of the tree, which means they are sweeter. But the branch they dangle from is much too thin for me to climb.
I hook my knees around the thick bough I'm on and lean back until I'm dangling upside down like a bat. It's fun to see the world this way, and I don't care that the hem of my dress is flapping around my face. Father always yells at me when he sees me like this, but he never stays angry at me for too long, on account of my losing my mother when I was just a baby. Wrapping my hands in the loose folds of my sleeves, I try to grab for the flowers, but I'm still too far from the branch she wants, those white flowers tantalizingly just out of reach.
If it's too much trouble, the nun calls out, don't worry about it. I don't want you to tear your dress.
I bite my bottom lip, determined to ignore her. By tightening and flexing the muscles in my belly and thighs, I begin to swing back and forth. When I've reached the apex of an upswing I judge to be high enough, I let go with my knees. As I plunge through the leafy canopy, the flowers she wants brush by my face, and I snap my teeth around a strand. My fingers grab the lower branch, which sinks under my weight and slows my momentum as my body swings back upright. For a moment, it seems as if the branch would hold. But then I hear a crisp snap and feel suddenly weightless. I tuck my knees under me and manage to land in the shade of the pagoda tree, unharmed. Immediately, I roll out of the way, and the flower-laden branch crashes to the spot on the ground I just vacated a moment later. I walk nonchalantly up to the nun and open my jaw to drop the strand of flowers into her alms bowl. No dust, and he only said no hands. In the shade of the pagoda tree, we sit with our legs crossed in the lotus position, like the Buddhas in the temple. She picks the flowers off the stem, one for her, one for me. The sweetness is lighter and less cloying than the sugar dough figurines Father sometimes buys me.
You have a talent, she says. You'd make a good thief.
I look at her, indignant. I'm a general's daughter.
Are you? She says. Then you're already a thief.
What are you talking about?
I have walked many miles, she says.
I look at her bare feet. The bottoms are calloused and leathery.
I see peasants starving in fields while the great lords plot and scheme for bigger armies. I see ministers and generals drink wine from ivory cups and conduct calligraphy with their piss on silk scrolls, while orphans and widows must make one cup of rice last 5 days.
Just because we are not poor doesn't make us thieves. My father serves his lord, the Jidushi of Weibo, with honor and carries out his duties faithfully.
We are all thieves in this world of suffering, the nun says. Honor and faith are not virtues, only excuses for stealing more.
Then you're a thief as well, I say, anger making my face glow with heat. You accept alms and do no work to earn them.
She nods. I am indeed. The Buddha teaches us that the world is an illusion and suffering is inevitable as long as we do not see through it. If we're all fated to be thieves, it's better to be a thief who adheres to a code that transcends the mundane.
What is your code, then?
To disdain the moral pronouncements of hypocrites, to be true to my word, to always do what I promise, no more and no less, to hone my talent and wield it like a beacon in a darkening world.
I laugh. What is your talent, Mistress Thief?
I steal lives.
The inside of the cabinet is dark and warm, the air redolent of camphor. By the faint light coming through the slit between the doors, I arrange the blankets around me to make a cozy nest. The footsteps of patrolling soldiers echo through the hallway outside my bedroom. Each time one of them turns a corner, the clanging of armor and sword marks the passage of another fraction of an hour, bringing me closer to morning. The conversation between the bhikkhuni and my father replays through my mind.
Give her to me. I will have her as my student. Much as I'm flattered by the Buddha's kind attention, I must decline. My daughter's place is at home, by my side. You can give her to me willingly, or I can take her away without your blessing. Are you threatening me with a kidnapping? Know that I've made my living on the tip of a sword, and my house is guarded by 50 armed men who will give their lives for their young mistress.
I never threaten. I simply inform. Even if you keep her in an iron chest, ringed about with bronze chains at the bottom of the ocean, I will take her away as easily as I cut your beard with this dagger. There was a cold, bright, metallic flash. Father drew his sword, the grinding noise of blade against sheath ringing my heart so that it leaped wildly. But the bhikkhuni was already gone, leaving behind a few loose strands of gray hair floating gently to the floor in the slanted rays of the sunlight. My father, stunned, held his hand against the side of his face where the dagger had brushed against his skin. The hairs landed. My father removed his hand. There was a patch of denuded skin on his cheek, as pale as the stone slabs of the road in the morning sun. No blood.
Do not be afraid, daughter. I will triple the guards tonight. The spirit of your dear departed mother will guard you.
But I'm afraid. I am afraid. I think about the glow of sunlight around the nun's head. I like my long, thick hair, which the maids tell me resembles my mother's, and she had combed her hair 100 times each night before she went to sleep. I don't want to have my head shaved. I think about the glint of metal in the nun's hand, quicker than the eye can follow. I think about the strands of hair from my father's beard drifting to the floor. The light from the oil lamp outside the closet door flickers. I scramble to the corner of the closet and squeeze my eyes tightly shut. There is no noise, just a draft that caresses my face, softly like the flapping wings of a moth. I open my eyes. For a moment, I don't understand what I'm seeing. Suspended about 3 feet from my face is an oblong object, about the size of my forearm and shaped like the cocoon of a silkworm. Glowing like a sliver of the moon, it gives off a light that is without warmth, shadowless. Fascinated, I crawl closer. No, an object isn't quite right. The cold light spills out of it like melting ice, along with the draft that whips my hair about my face. It is more like the absence of substance, a rip in the murky interior of the cabinet, a negative object that consumes darkness and turns it into light. My throat feels parched, and I swallow hard. Fingers trembling, I reach out to touch the glow. A half second of hesitation, then I make contact. Or no contact. There is no skin-searing heat, nor bone-freezing chill. My impression of the object as a negative is confirmed, as my fingers touch nothing, and neither do they emerge from the other side. They've simply vanished into the glow, as though I'm plunging my hand into a hole in space. I jerk my hand back out and examine my fingers, wiggling them. No damage as far as I can see. A hand reaches out from the rip, grabs my arm, and pulls me toward the light, Before I can scream, blazing light blinds me, and I'm overwhelmed by the sensation of falling, falling from the tip of a heaven-reaching pagoda tree toward an earth that never comes. The mountain floats among the clouds like an island. I've tried to find my way down, but always I get lost among the foggy woods. Just go down, down, I tell myself. But the fog thickens until it takes on substance, and no matter how hard I push, the wall of clouds refuses to yield. Then I have no choice but to sit down, shivering, wringing the condensation out of my hair. Some of the wetness is from tears, but I won't admit that. She materializes out of the fog. Wordlessly, she beckons me to follow her back up the peak. I obey.
You're not very good at hiding, she says.
There is no response to that. If she could steal me from a cabinet inside a general's house guarded by walls and soldiers, I suppose there's nowhere I can hide from her. We emerge from the woods back onto the sun-drenched peak. A gust of wind brushes past us, whipping up the fallen leaves into a storm of gold and crimson.
Are you hungry?
She asks, her voice not unkind. I nod. Something about her tone catches me off guard. Father never asks me if I'm hungry, and I sometimes dream of my mother making me a breakfast of freshly baked bread and fermented beans. It's been 3 days since the Bikuni had taken me here, and I've not eaten anything but some sour berries I found in the woods and a few bitter roots I dug from the ground.
Come along, she says.
She takes me up the zigzagging path carved into the face of a cliff. The path is so narrow that I dare not look down but shuffle along, my face and body pressed against the rock face, and my outstretched hands clinging to dangling vines like a gecko. The Bikuni, on the other hand, strides along the path as though she's walking in the middle of a wide avenue in Chang'an. She waits patiently at each turn for me to catch up. I hear the faint sounds of clanking metal above me. Having dug my feet into depressions along the path and tested the vine in my hands to be sure it's rooted securely to the mountain, I look up. 2 young women, about 14 years of age, are fighting with swords in the air. No, fighting isn't quite the right word. It's more accurate to call their movements a dance. One of the women, dressed in a white robe, pushes off the cliff with both feet while holding on to a vine with her left hand. She swings away from the cliff in a wide arc, her legs stretched out before her in a graceful pose that reminds me of the apsaras, flying nymphs who make their home in the clouds, painted on scrolls in the temples. The sword in her right hand glints in the sunlight like a shard of heaven. As her sword tip approaches her opponent on the cliff, the other woman lets go of the vine she's hanging onto and leaps straight up. The black robe billows around her like the wings of a giant moth, and as her ascent slows, she flips herself at the apex of her arc and tumbles toward the woman in white like a diving hawk, her sword arm leading as a beak. Clang! The tips of their swords collide, and a spark lights up the air like an exploding firework. The sword in the hand of the woman in black bends into a crescent, slowing her descent until she is standing inverted in the air, supported only by the tip of her adversary's blade. Both women punch out with their free hands, palms open. Thump! A crisp blow reverberates in the air. The woman in black lands against the mountain face, where she attaches herself by deftly wrapping a vine around her ankle. The woman in white completes her arced swing back to the rock, and like a dragonfly dipping its tail into the still pond, pushes off again for another assault. I watch, mesmerized, as the 2 swordswomen pursue, dodge, strike, feint, punch, kick, slash, glide, tumble and stab across the webbing of vines over the face of the sheer cliff, thousands of feet above the roiling clouds below,
defying both gravity and mortality. They are graceful as birds, flitting across a swaying bamboo forest, quick as mantises leaping across a dew-dappled web, impossible as the immortals of legends, whispered by hoarse-voiced bards in tea-houses. Also, I notice with relief that they both have thick, flowing, beautiful hair. Perhaps shaving is not required to be the bhikkhuni's student.
Come, the bhikkhuni beckons,
and I obediently make my way over to the small stone platform jutting into the air from the bend in the path.
I guess you really are hungry,
she observes, a hint of laughter in her voice. Embarrassed, I close my jaw, still hanging open from shock at seeing the sparring girls. With the clouds far below our feet and the wind whipping around us, it feels like the world I've known all my life has fallen away.
Here.
She points to a pile of bright pink peaches at the end of the platform, each about the size of my fist.
The 100-year-old monkeys who live in the mountains gather these from deep in the clouds, where the peach trees absorb the essence of the heavens. After eating one of these, you won't be hungry for a full 10 days. If you become thirsty, you can drink the dew from the vines and the spring water in the cave that is our dormitory.
The two sparring girls have climbed down from the cliff onto the platform behind us. They each take a peach.
I will show you where you'll sleep, little sister, says the girl in white. I'm Ginger. If you get scared from the howling wolves at night, you can crawl into my bed.
I'm sure you've never had anything as sweet as this peach, says the girl in black. I'm Conger. I've studied with teacher the longest and know all the fruits of this mountain. Have you had pagoda tree flowers? I ask.
No, she says. Maybe someday you can show me.
I bite into the peach. It is indescribably sweet and melts against my tongue as though it's made of pure snow. Yet as soon as I've swallowed a mouthful, my belly warms with the heat of its sustenance. I believe that the peach really will last me 10 days. I'll believe anything my teacher tells me.
Why have you taken me? I ask.
Because you have a talent, Yen Yang, she says.
I suppose that is my name now, the hidden girl.
But talents must be cultivated, she continues. Will you be a pearl buried in the mud of the endless East Sea, or will you shine so brightly as to awaken those who only doze through life and light up a mundane world?
Teach me to fly and fight like them, I say, licking the sweet peach juice from my hands.
I will become a great thief, I tell myself. I will steal my life back from you. She nods thoughtfully and looks into the distance, where the setting sun has turned the clouds into a sea of golden splendor and crimson gore. 6 years later, the wheels of the donkey cart grind to a stop. Without warning, teacher rips the blindfold away from my eyes and digs out the silk plugs in my ears. I struggle against the sudden bright sun and the sea of noise, the braying of donkeys, the whinnying of horses, the clanging of cymbals and the wailing of air hoos from some folk opera troupe, the thumping and thudding of goods being loaded and unloaded, the singing, shouting, haggling, laughing, arguing, pontificating that make up the symphony of a metropolis. While I'm still recovering from my journey in the swaying darkness, teacher has jumped down to the ground to leash the donkey to a roadside post. We're in some provincial capital, that much I know. Indeed, the smell of 100 different varieties of fried dough and candied apples and horse manure and exotic perfume already told me as much, even before the blindfold was off. But I can't tell exactly where.
I strain to catch snippets of conversation from the bustling city around me, but the top-elect is unfamiliar. The pedestrians passing by our cart bow to teacher. "Amitabha," they say. Teacher holds up a hand in front of her chest and bows back.
"Amitabha," she says back.
I may be anywhere in the empire.
"We'll have lunch. Then you can rest up at the inn over there," says teacher.
"What about my task?" I ask. I'm nervous. This is the first time I've been away from the mountain since she's taken me. She looks at me with a complicated expression, halfway between pity and amusement.
"So eager."
I bite my bottom lip, not answering.
"You will choose your own method and time,"
she says, her tone as placid as the cloudless sky.
"I'll be back on the third night. Good hunting. Keep your eyes open and your limbs loose," she said. "Remember everything I've taught you."
Teacher had summoned two mist hawks from nearby peaks, each the size of a full-grown man. Iron blades extended from their talons, and steel glinted from their vicious, curved beaks. They circled above me, alternately emerging from and disappearing into the cloud mist. Their screeches mournful and proud. Ginger handed me a small dagger, about 5 inches in length. It seemed utterly inadequate for the task. My hand shook as I wrapped my fingers around the handle.
"What can be seen is not all," she said.
"Be aware of what is hidden," Conger added.
"You will be fine,"
Ginger said, squeezing my shoulder. "The world is full of illusions cast by the unseen truth," Conger said. Then she leaned in to whisper in my ear, her breath warm against my cheek. "I still have a scar on the back of my neck from my time with the hawks." They backed off and faded into the mist, leaving me alone with the raptors and teacher's voice coming from the vines above me. "Why do we kill?" I asked. The hawks took turns swooping down, feinting and testing my defenses. I leapt out of the way reflexively, brandishing my dagger to ward them off.
"This is a time of chaos," teacher said. "The great lords of the land are filled with ambition. They take everything they can from the people they're sworn to protect. Shepherds who have turned into wolves, preying on their flocks. They increase the taxes until all the walls in their palaces are gleaming with gold and silver. They take sons away from mothers until their armies swell like the current of the Yellow River. They plot and scheme and redraw lines on maps, as though the country is nothing but a platter of sand, upon which the peasants creep and crawl like terrified ants." One of the hawks turned to dive at me, a real attack, not a test. I crouched into a defensive stance, the dagger in my right hand held up to guard my face, my left hand on the ground for stability. I kept my eyes on the hawk, letting everything fade into the background, except the bright reflections from the sharp beak and talons, like a constellation in the night sky. The hawk loomed in my vision. A light breeze brushed the back of my neck. The raptor extended its talons and flapped its wings, trying to slow its dive at the last minute. Who is to say that one governor is right? Or that another general is wrong?
She asked.
The man who seduces his lord's wife may be doing so to get close to a tyrant and exact vengeance. The woman who demands rice for the peasantry from her patron may be doing so to further her own ambition. We live in a time of chaos, and the only moral choice is to be amoral. The great lords hire us to strike at their enemies, and we carry out our missions with dedication and loyalty, true and deadly as a crossbow bolt.
I got ready to spring out of my crouch to slash at the hawk. Then I remembered the words of my sisters. What can be seen is not all. I still have a scar on the back of my neck. I dropped to the ground and rolled to the left, the talons of the hawk who had been trying to sneak up behind me, missing only by inches. It collided with its companion in the spot where my head had been but a moment ago, like a diver meeting her reflection at the surface of the pool. There was a tangle of beating wings and angry screeching. I lunged at the storm of feathers, one, two, three slashes, quicker than lightning. The hawks tumbled down, their wings crumpling as they struck the ground. Blood from the clean cuts in their throats pooled on the stone platform. There was also blood seeping from my shoulder, where the rough rocks had scraped the skin during my roll. But I had survived, and my foes had not.
"Why do we kill?" I asked again, still panting from the exertion. I had killed wild apes before, and forest panthers, and bamboo grove tigers. But a pair of mist hawks were the hardest kill yet, the height of the assassin's art. "Why do we serve as the talons of the powerful?"
"We are the winter snowstorm descending upon a house rotten with termites," she said. "Only by hurrying the decay of the old can we bring about the rebirth of the new. We are the vengeance of a weary world."
Ginger and Conger emerged from the mist to sprinkle corpse-dissolving powder on the hawks and to bandage my wound.
"Thank you," I whispered. "You need to practice more," said Ginger, but her tone was kind.
"I have to keep you alive."
Conger's eyes flashed mischievously. "You promised to get me some pagoda tree flowers, remember?"
The thin crescent of the moon hangs from the tip of a branch of the ancient pagoda tree outside the governor's mansion as the night watchman rings the midnight hour. The shadows in the streets are thick as ink, the same color as my silk leggings, tight tunic, and the cloth mask over my nose and mouth. I'm upside down, my feet hooked to the top of the wall, and my body pressed against the flat surface like a clinging vine. Two soldiers pass below me on their patrol route. If they looked up, they'd think I was just a part of the shadows or a sleeping bat. As soon as they're gone, I arch my back and flip onto the wall. I scramble along the top, quieter than a cat, until I'm opposite the roof of the central hall of the compound. Snapping my coiled legs, I sail across the gap in a single leap and melt into the shingles on the gentle curve of the roof. There are, of course, far stealthier ways to break into a well-protected compound, but I like to stay in this world, to remain surrounded by the night breeze and the distant hoots of the owl. Carefully, I pry off a glazed roofing tile and peek into the gap. Through the latticed underroof, I see a brightly lit hall paved with stones. A middle-aged man sits on a dais at the eastern end, his eyes intent upon a bundle of papers, flipping through the pages slowly. I see a birthmark, the shape of a butterfly on his left cheek, and a jade collar around his neck. He is the Jidushi I'm supposed to kill. "Steal his life, and your apprenticeship will be completed," teacher said. "This is your last test."
"What has he done that he deserves to die?" I asked.
"Does it matter? It is enough that a man who once saved my life wants this man to die, and that he has paid handsomely for it. We amplify the forces of ambition and strife. We hold on to only our code."
I crawl over the roof, my palms and feet gliding over the tiles smoothly, making no sound. Teacher trained us by having us glide across the valley lake in March, when the ice is so thin that even squirrels sometimes fall through and drown. I feel one with the night,
My senses sharpened like the tip of my dagger. Excitement is tinged with a hint of sorrow, like the first stroke of the paintbrush on a fresh sheet of paper. Now that I'm directly above where the governor is sitting, once again I pry off one tile, then another. I make a hole big enough for me to slink through. Then I take out the grappling hook from my pouch, painted black to prevent reflections, and toss it to the apex ridge so that the claws dig in securely. Then I tie the silk cord around my waist. I look down through the hole in the roof. The Jidushi is still where he was, oblivious to the mortal danger over his head. For a moment, I suffer the illusion that I'm back in the great pagoda tree in front of my house, looking through a hole in the swaying leaves at my father. But the moment passes. I'm going to dive through like a cormorant, slit his throat, strip off his clothes, and sprinkle corpse-dissolving powder all over his skin. Then, as he lies there on the stone floor, still twitching, I will take flight back to the ceiling and make my escape. By the time servants discover the remains of his body, barely more than a skeleton, I will be long gone. Teacher will declare my apprenticeship to be at an end, myself an equal of my sister's. I take a deep breath. My body is coiled. I've trained and practiced for this moment for 6 years. I'm ready.
Baba!
I hold still. The boy who emerges from behind the curtains is about 6 years old, his hair tied into a neat little braid that points straight up like the tail of a rooster.
What are you doing still up? The man asks. Be a good boy and go back to sleep.
I can't sleep, the boy says. I heard a noise, and I saw a shadow moving on the courtyard wall.
Just a cat, the man says.
The boy looks unconvinced. The man looks thoughtful for a moment, then says,
All right, come over.
He sets the papers aside on the low desk next to him. The boy scrambles into his lap.
Shadows are nothing to be afraid of, he says.
Then he proceeds to make a series of shadow puppets with his hands held against the reading light. He teaches the boy how to make a butterfly, a puppy, a bat, a sinuous dragon. The boy laughs in delight. Then the boy makes a kitten to chase his father's butterfly across the papered windows of the large hall.
Shadows are given life by light, and they also die by light.
The man stops fluttering his fingers and lets his hands fall by his side.
Go to sleep, child. In the morning, you can chase real butterflies in the garden.
The boy, heavy-eyed, nods and leaves quietly. On the roof, I hesitate. The boy's laughter will not leave my mind. Can the girl stolen from her family steal family away from another child? Is this the moral pronouncement of a hypocrite?
Thank you for waiting until my son has left,
the man says. I freeze. There's no one in the hall but him, and he's too loud to be talking to himself.
I prefer not to shout, he says,
his eyes still on the bundle of papers.
It would be easier if you came down.
The pounding of my heart is a roar in my ears. I should flee immediately. This is probably a trap. If I go down, he might have soldiers in ambush or some mechanism under the floor of the hall to capture me. Yet something in his voice compels me to obey. I drop through the hole in the roof, the silk cord attached to the grappling hook looped about my waist a few times to slow my descent. I land gently before the dais, silent as a snowflake. How did you know? I ask. The bricks at my feet have not flipped open to reveal a yawning pit, and no soldiers have rushed from behind the screens. But my hands grip the cord tightly, and my knees are ready to snap. I can still complete my mission if he truly is defenseless.
Children have sharper ears than their parents, he says, and I have long made shadow puppets for my own amusement while reading late at night. I know how much the lights in this hall usually flicker, without the draft from a new opening in the ceiling.
I nod. It's a good lesson for the next time. My right hand moves to grasp the handle of the dagger in the sheath at the small of my back.
Jidushi Lu of Qinsu is ambitious, he says. He has coveted my territory for a long time, thinking of pressing the young men in its rich fields into his army. If you strike me down, there will be no one to stand between him and the throne in Chang'an. Millions will die as his rebellion sweeps across the empire. Hundreds of thousands of children will become orphans. Ghostly multitudes will wander the land, their souls unable to rest as beasts pick through their corpses.
The numbers he speaks of are vast, like the countless grains of sand suspended in the turbid waters of the Yellow River. I can't make any sense of them. He saved my teacher's life once, I say.
And so you will do as she asks, blind to all other concerns?
The world is rotten through, I say. I have my duty.
I cannot say that my hands are free of blood. Perhaps this is what comes of making compromises.
He sighs.
Will you at least allow me 2 days to put my affairs in order? My wife departed this world when my son was born, and I have to arrange for his care.
I stare at him. I can't treat the boy's laughter as an illusion. I picture the governor surrounding his house with thousands of soldiers. I picture him hiding in the cellar, trembling like a leaf in autumn. I picture him on the road away from this city, whipping his horse again and again, grimacing like a desperate marionette. As if reading my mind, he says,
I will be here, alone, in 2 nights. I give you my word.
What is the word of a man about to die worth? I counter.
As much as the word of an assassin, he says.
I nod and leap up, scrambling up the dangling rope as swiftly as I ascend one of the vines on the cliff at home. I disappear through the hole in the roof. I'm not worried about the Jidushis escaping. I've been trained well, and I will catch him no matter where he runs. I'd rather give him the chance to spend some time saying goodbye to his little boy. It seems right. I wander the markets of the city, soaking up the smell of fried dough and caramelized sugar. My stomach growls at the memory of foods I have not had in 6 years. Eating peaches and drinking dew may have purified my spirit, but the flesh still yearns for earthly sweetness. I speak to the vendors in the language of the court, and at least some of them have a passing mastery of it. That is very skillfully made, I say, looking at a sugar dough general on a stick. The figurine is wearing a bright red war cape, glazed with jujube juice. My mouth waters.
Would you like to have it? The vendor asks. It's very fresh, young mistress. I made it only this morning. The filling is lotus paste.
I don't have any money, I say regretfully. Teacher gave me only enough money for lodging and a dried peach for food. The vendor considers me and seems to make up his mind.
By your accent, I take it you're not a local.
I nod.
Away from home to find a pool of tranquility in this chaotic world?
Something like that, I say. He nods, as if this explains everything. He hands the stick of the sugar dough general to me.
From one wanderer to another, then.
This is a good place to settle. I accept the gift and thank him. Where are you from?
Jinsu. I abandoned my fields and ran away, when the Jidushi Lu's men came to my village to draft boys and men for the army. I had already lost my father, and I wasn't interested in dying to add color to his war cape. That figurine is modeled after Jidushi Lu. It gives me pleasure to watch patrons bite his head off.
I laugh and oblige him. The sugar dough melts on the tongue, and the succulent lotus paste that oozes out is delightful. I walk about the alleyways and streets of the city, savoring every bite of the sugar dough figurine, as I listen to snatches of conversation wafting from the doors of tea houses and passing carriages.
Why should we send her across the city to learn dance? The magistrate isn't going to look kindly on such deception. The best fish I've ever had. It was still flapping.
How can you tell? What did he say? Tell me, sister, tell. The rhythm of life flows around me, buoying me up like the sea of clouds on the mountain when I swing from vine to vine. I think about the words of the man I'm supposed to kill. Millions will die as his rebellion sweeps across the empire. Hundreds of thousands of children will become orphans. Ghostly multitudes will wander the land. I think about his son and the shadows flitting across the walls of the vast empty hall. Something in my heart throbs to the music of this world, at once mundane and holy. The grains of sand swirling in the water resolve into individual faces, laughing, crying, yearning, dreaming. On the third night, the crescent moon is a bit wider, the wind a bit chillier, and the hooting of the owls in the distance a shade more ominous. I scale the wall of the governor's compound as before. The patrolling patterns of the soldiers have not changed. This time, I crouch even lower and move even more silently across the branch-thin top of the wall and the uneven surface of roofing tiles. I'm back at the familiar spot. I pry up a roof tile that I had put back two nights earlier and press my eye against the slit to block the draft, anticipating at any moment masked guards leaping out of the darkness to spring their trap. Not to worry. I'm ready. But there are no shouts of alarm and no clanging of the gong. I gaze down into the well-lit hall. He is sitting in the same spot, a stack of papers on the desk by him. I listen hard for the footsteps of a child. Nothing. The boy has been sent away. I examine the floor of the hall beneath where the man sits. It's strewn with straw. The sight confuses me for a moment, before I realize that it's an act of kindness. He wants to keep his blood from staining the bricks, so that whoever has to clean up the mess will have an easier time. The man sits in the lotus position, eyes closed, a beatific smile on his face like a statue of the Buddha. Gently, I place the tile back in place and disappear into the night like a breeze.
Why have you not completed your task? Teacher asks.
My sisters stand behind her, two arhats guarding their mistress. He was playing with his child, I say. I hold on to the explanation like a vine swaying over an abyss. She sighs.
Next time this happens, you should kill the boy first, so that you're no longer distracted.
I shake my head.
It is a trick. He is playing upon your sympathies. The powerful are all actors upon a stage, their hearts as unfathomable as shadows.
That may be, I say. Still, he kept his word and was willing to die at my hand. I believe other things he's told me may be true as well.
How do you know he is not as ambitious as the man he maligns? How do you know he is not only being kind in service of a greater cruelty in the future? No one knows the future, I say. The house may be rotten through, but I'm unwilling to be the hand that brings it tumbling down upon the ants, seeking a pool of tranquility. She stares at me.
What of loyalty? What of obedience to your teacher? What of carrying out that which you promised to do?
I'm not meant to be a thief of lives, I say.
So much talent, she says.
Then after a pause,
wasted.
Something about her tone makes me shiver. Then I look behind her and see that Ginger and Conger are gone.
If you leave, she says, you are no longer my student.
I look at her unlined face and not unkind eyes. I think about the times she bandaged my legs after I fell from the vines in the early days. I think about the time she fought off the bamboo grove bear when it proved too much for me. I think about the nights she held me and taught me to see through the world's illusions to the truth beneath. She had taken me away from my family, but she has also been the closest thing to a mother I know. Goodbye, teacher. I crouch and leap like a bounding tiger, like a soaring wild ape, like a hawk taking flight. I smash through the window of the room in the inn and dive into the ocean that is night. I'm not here to kill you, I say. The man nods as if this is entirely expected. My sisters, Ginger, also known as the Heart of Lightning, and Conger, the empty-handed, have been dispatched to complete what I cannot.
I will summon my guards, he says, standing up.
That won't do any good, I tell him. Ginger can steal your soul, even if you were hiding inside a bell at the bottom of the ocean, and Conger is even more skillful. He smiled.
Then I will face them alone. Thank you for the warning, so that my men do not die needlessly.
A faint shrieking noise, like a distant troop of howling monkeys, can be heard in the night. There's no time to explain, I tell him. Give me your red scarf. He does, and I tie the scarf about my waist. You will see things that seem beyond comprehension. Whatever happens, keep your eye on this scarf and stay away from it. The howling grows louder. It seems to come from everywhere and nowhere. Ginger is here. Before he has time to question me further, I rip open a seam in space and crawl in to vanish from his sight, leaving only the tip of the bright red scarf dangling behind.
Imagine that space is a sheet of paper, teacher said. An ant crawling on this sheet of paper is aware of breadth and depth, but has no awareness of height.
I looked at the ant she had sketched on the paper, expectant.
The ant is terrified of danger and builds a wall around him, thinking that such an impregnable barrier will keep him safe.
Teacher sketches a ring around the ant,
but unbeknownst to the ant, a knife is poised above him. It is not part of the ant's world, invisible to him. The wall he has built will do nothing to protect him against a strike from a hidden direction. She throws her dagger at the paper, pinning the painted ant to the ground. You may think width, depth, and height are the only dimensions of the world, hidden girl, but you'd be wrong. You have lived your life as an ant on a sheet of paper, and the truth is far more wondrous.
I emerge into the space above space, the space within space, the hidden space. Everything gains a new dimension. The walls, the floor tiles, the flickering torches, the astonished face of the governor. It is as if the governor's skin has been pulled away to reveal everything underneath. I see his beating heart, his pulsating intestines,
the blood streaming through his transparent vessels, his gleaming white bones, as well as the velvety marrow stuffed inside like jujube-stained lotus paste. I see each grain of shiny mica inside each brick. I see 10,000 immortals dancing inside each flame. No, that's not quite accurate. I have not the words to describe what I see. I see 1,000,000,000 layers to everything at once, like an ant who has always seen a line before him, suddenly lifted off the page to realize the perfection of a circle. This is the perspective of the Buddha, who comprehends the incomprehensibility of Indra's net, which connects the smallest moat at the tip of a flea's foot to the grandest river of innumerable stars that spans the sky at night. This was how, years ago, Teacher had penetrated the walls of my father's compound, evaded my father's soldiers, and seized me from within the tightly sealed cabinet. I see the approaching white robe of Ginger, bobbing like a glowing jellyfish in the vast deep. She ululates as she approaches, a single voice making a cacophony of howling that sends terror into the hearts of her victims.
Little sister, what are you doing here?
I lift my dagger. Please, Ginger, go back. You've always been a bit too stubborn, she says. We have eaten from the same peach and bathed in the same cold mountain spring, I say. You taught me how to climb the vines and how to pick the ice lilies for my hair. I love you like a sister of the blood. Please don't do this. She looks sad.
I can't. Teacher has promised.
There's a greater promise we all must live by, to do what our heart tells us is right. She lifts her sword.
Because I love you like a sister, I will let you strike at me without hitting back. If you can hit me before I kill the governor, I will leave.
I nod. Thank you. And I'm sorry it's come to this. The hidden space has its own structure, made from dangling thin strands that glow faintly with an inner light. To move in this space, Ginger and I leap from vine to vine and swing from filament to filament, climbing, tumbling, pivoting, lurching, dancing on a lattice woven from starlight and lambent ice. I lunge after her. She easily dodges out of the way. She has always been the best at vine fighting and cloud dancing. She glides and swings as gracefully as an immortal of the heavenly court. Compared to her, my moves are lumbering, heavy, lacking all finesse. As she dances away from my strikes, she counts them off. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Very nice, hidden girl. You've been practicing. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Once in a while, when I get too close, she parries my dagger with her sword as effortlessly as a dozing man swats away a fly. Almost pityingly, she swivels out of my way and swings toward the governor. Like a knife poised above the page, she's completely invisible to him, falling upon him from another dimension. I lurch after her, hoping that I'm close enough to her for my plan to work. The governor, seeing the red scarf I dangle into his world approach, drops to the ground and rolls out of the way. Ginger's sword pierces through the veil between dimensions, and in that world, a sword emerges from the air and smashes the desk the governor was sitting behind into smithereens before disappearing.
Eh? How can he see me coming?
Without giving her a chance to figure out my trick, I launch a fusillade of dagger strikes.
31, 32, 3, 4, 5, 6.
You're really getting better at this. We dance around in the space above the hall. There's no word for this direction, and each time, as Ginger goes after the governor, I try to stay right next to her to warn the governor of the hidden danger.
Try as I might, I can't touch her at all. I can feel myself getting tired, slowing down. I flex my legs and swing after her again, but this time I'm careless and come too close to the wall of the hall. My dangling scarf catches on the sconce for a torch, and I fall to my feet. Ginger looks at me and laughs.
So that's how you've been doing it. Clever, hidden girl. But now the game is over, and I'm about to claim my prize.
If she strikes at the governor now, he won't have any warning at all. I'm stuck here. The scarf catches fire, and the flame erupts into the hidden space. I scream with terror as the flame engulfs my robe. With three quick leaps, Ginger is back on the same strand I'm on. She whips off her white robe and wraps it around me, helping me smother the flames.
Are you all right? She asks.
The fire has singed my hair and charred my skin in a few places, but I'll be fine.
Thank you, I say.
Then before she can react, I whip my dagger across the hem of her robe and cut off a strip of cloth. The tip of my dagger continues to slice open the veil between dimensions, and the strip drifts into the ordinary world, like flotsam bobbing to the surface. We both see the governor's shocked face as he scrambles away from the white silk patch on the floor.
A hit, I say.
Ah, she says, that's not really fair, is it?
Nonetheless, it's a strike, I say.
So that fall, it was all planned?
This was the only way I could think of, I admit.
You're a far superior sword fighter. She shakes her head. How can you care for a stranger more than your sister? But I gave you my word. She climbs up and glides away like a departing water spirit. Just before she fades into the night, she turns to look at me one last time.
Farewell, little sister. Our bond has been severed as surely as you've cut through my dress. May you find your purpose.
Farewell. She leaves, ululating all the while. I crawl back into ordinary space, and the governor rushes up to me.
I was so frightened. What kind of magic is this? I heard the clanging of swords, but could see nothing. Your scarf danced in the air like a ghost, and then, finally, that white cloth materialized out of nowhere. Wait, are you hurt?
I grimace and sit up. It's nothing. Ginger is gone, but the next assassin will be my other sister, Conger, who is far more deadly. I do not know if I can protect you.
I'm not afraid to die, he says.
If you die, the Jidushi of Chinsu will slaughter many more, I say. You must listen to me. I open my pouch and take out my teacher's gift to me on my 15th birthday. I hand it to him.
This is a paper donkey?
He looks at me puzzled. This is the projection of a mechanical donkey into our world, I say. It's like how a sphere passing through a plane would appear as a circle.
Never mind, there's no time. Here, you must go.
I rip open space and shove him through it. The donkey looms now before him as a giant mechanical beast. Despite his protests, I push him onto the donkey. Tightly wound sinew will power the spinning gears inside and move the legs on cranks, and the donkey will gallop off in a wide circle in the hidden space for an hour, springing from glowing vine to vine, like a wire walker. Teacher had given it to me to help me escape if I'm hurt on a mission.
How will you defend against her?
He asks. I pull out the key, and the donkey gallops away, leaving his query unanswered. There is no howling, no singing, no terrifying din. When Conger approaches, she is completely silent. If you don't know her, you will think she has no weapon. That is why she is nicknamed the Empty-Handed. The robe is hot, and the dough makeup on my face heavy.
The hall is filled with smoke from the scattered straw on the floor I've set on fire. I crouch down on the floor where the air is clearer and cooler so I can breathe. I put on a beatific smile, but keep my eyes slitted open. The smoke swirls, a gentle disturbance that you'd miss if you weren't paying attention. I know how much the lights in this hall usually flicker without the draft from a new opening in the ceiling. Moments earlier, I had carefully cut a few fissures in the veil between dimensions with my dagger and kept them open with strands of silk torn from Ginger's robe. The openings were enough to let a draft through from the hidden space, enough to let me detect an approaching presence beyond. I picture Conger with her implacable mien, gliding toward me in hidden space like a soul-taking demon. A needle glints in her right hand, the only weapon she needs. She prefers to approach her victims in the unseen dimension, to prick the inside from the undefended direction. She likes to press the needle into the middle of their hearts, leaving the ribcage and the skin intact. She likes to probe the needle into their skulls and stir their brains into mush, driving them insane before their deaths, but leaving no wound in the skull. The smoke stirs some more. She's close now. I imagine the scene from her point of view. A man dressed in the robe of a jidushi is sitting in the smoke-filled hall, a birthmark the shape of a butterfly on his cheek. He's terrified into indecision, the rictus of a foolish smile frozen on his face, even as his home burns around him. Somehow, the air in the hidden space over him is murky, as though the smoke from the hall has transcended the veil between dimensions. She lunges. I shift to the right, moving by instinct rather than sense. I have sparred with her for years, and I hope she moves as she has always done. She meant to press her needle into my skull, but since I've moved out of the way, her needle pierces into the world at the spot where my head was, and with a crisp clang, strikes against the jade collar I'm wearing around my neck. I stagger up, coughing in the smoke. I wipe off the dough makeup from my face. Conger's needle is so fragile that after one impact it is bent out of shape. She never attacks a second time if the first attempt fails. A surprised giggle.
A good trick, hidden girl. I should have gotten a better look through all that smoke. You've always been teacher's favorite student.
The crevices I carved between the worlds were for more than just warning. By filling the hidden space with smoke, her view of the ordinary world had become indistinct. Ordinarily, from her vantage point, my mask would have been but a transparent shell, and the bulky robe would not have concealed the slender body underneath. But maybe, just maybe, she chose to not see through my poor disguise, the same way she once chose to warn me of the hawk swooping down behind me. I bow to the unseen speaker. Tell teacher I'm sorry, but I won't be returning to the mountain.
Who knew you would turn out to be an anti-assassin?
We will see each other again, I hope.
I will invite you to share some pagoda tree flowers then, elder sister.
A tinge of bitterness at the heart of something sweet makes it less cloying. Peals of laughter fade, and I collapse to the ground, exhausted. I think about heading home, about seeing my father again. What will I tell him about my time away? How can I explain to him that I've changed? I will not be able to grow up the way he wants. There is too much wildness in me. I cannot put on a confining dress and glide through the rooms of the compound, blushing as the matchmaker explains which boy I will marry. I cannot pretend to be more interested in my sewing than I am in climbing the pagoda tree next to the gate. I have a talent. I want to scale walls like Ginger, Conger, and I used to swing from vine to vine over the cliff face.
I want to cross swords against worthy opponents. I want to pick a boy to marry. I'm thinking someone who is kind and has soft hands. Maybe someone who grinds mirrors for a living, so that he will know that there is another dimension beyond the smooth surface. I want to hone my talent so that it shines brightly, terrorizing the unjust and lighting the way for those who would make the world better. I will protect the innocent and guard the timid. I do not know if I will always do what is right, but I am the hidden girl, and my loyalty is to the tranquility yearned by all. I am a thief after all. I've stolen my life for myself, and I will steal back the lives of others. The sound of beating mechanical hooves approaches.
Matthew Hughes. Matthew Hughes was born in Liverpool, England, but has spent most of his adult life in Canada. He's worked as a journalist, as a staff speechwriter for the Canadian Ministers of Justice and Environment, and as a freelance corporate and political speechwriter in British Columbia, before settling down to write fiction full-time. Clearly strongly influenced by Jack Vance, as an author, Hughes has made his reputation detailing the adventures of characters like Hengus Hapthorne, Guth Bandar, and Luff Imbri, who live in the era just before that of the Dying Earth, in a series of popular stories and novels that include Fool's Errant, Fool Me Twice, Black Brilliant, Maidstrom, Hespera, The Spiral Labyrinth, Template, Quartet and Triptych, The Yellow Cabochon, The Other, and The Commons, with his stories being collected in The Gist Hunter and Other Stories, and The Meaning of Luff and Other Stories. He's also written the urban fantasy To Hell and Back trilogy, The Damned Busters, Costume Not Included, and Hell to Pay. He also writes crime fiction as Matt Hughes and media tie-in novels as Hugh Matthews. His most recent books are the Luff Imbri novellas Of Whimsies and Noobles and Epiphanies, the science fantasy novel A Wizard's Henchman, and the collection Devil or Angel and Other Stories. In the flamboyant story that follows, a wizard's henchman bungles an important mission and finds that he has to deal with the cascading sequence of wildly extravagant consequences.
The Sword of Destiny by Matthew Hughes. Baldemar ran across the flat roof at his best speed, though he was hampered by the scabbarded sword thrust through his broad belt. When he had lifted it out of its cradle, he had slipped it through at his hip, but during the race up the stairs, it had somehow worked its way around to the rear, and now it struck the back of his left calf with every other step. But there was no time to stop and adjust matters. The herbs that guarded the house were already emerging from the trap door, and at once their preternatural sensory organs locked on to the fleeing thief. A strange, wavering cry, like that of a weak and hungry child, rose from each of the three long, scaly throats, and Baldemar heard the click of razor-edged claws on the roof's flagstone surface. The neighboring building overtopped this one by several stories, and from its ornamental cornices hung a rope. Baldemar had arranged it to be his emergency escape should the operation go amiss. But between the two buildings was a space as wide as Baldemar was tall, and that gap was still a good 10 paces away. Or a very bad 10 paces, if the herbs caught him before he reached it. There was nothing for it but to drag out the sword and let it drop, in the hope that the watch beasts would stop to guard it, that being their function. He yanked the eldritch weapon free and let it fall. But the staccato clicking of claws did not break its rhythm, and now the eerie howl of the creatures was loud in his ears, its pitch rising. "That's the sound," the thought went through his head. "They make just before they seize their prey." 2 more strides and the lip of the roof was below the ball of his right foot. He kicked off, flung himself into space, just as a reaching claw sliced through the cloth of his shirt and left a long, vertical scratch down the middle of his back. But the lead herb, it would have been the big female, was not poised to leap and could not stop. She tumbled over the edge of the roof, and the cry she gave as she plummeted to the pavement below was almost human in its disappointment. But the other two, her grown pups, were lighter and younger. They pulled up at the brink, their jaws clacking in fury, as Baldemar's fingers connected with the rope and, unfortunately, with the brick wall against which it hung. He felt a bone snap in the middle finger of his left hand, but he ignored the pain and clung to the thick hemp, immediately reaching up with his right to haul himself higher, while the toes of his boots scrabbled for purchase against the wall. He began to climb, but had scarcely risen a body length before he heard again the sound the herb's dam had belled just before her claw had raked his skin, followed immediately by a thump as the body of one of her brood struck the wall below him. "Down you go too," was his happy thought, until he discovered he was celebrating too soon. The creature's forearms had reached out as it leapt the gap, and one of its grasping hands made contact. A talon tore through his right legging and gouged his calf muscle, the pain lancing up through his body to resonate with the ache in his broken finger. Baldemar gave his own cry now, of pain and fear, as the herb's weight caused the claw to slice downward through the leg muscle until it met the curled-over leather at the top of his boot. Now he had the beast's weight as well as his own hanging from his diminished grip on the rope. The injured hand told him it was not up to the task, and he knew that he must change the situation or join the herb and its mother down below in a welter of broken bones and burst bodies. With his unencumbered foot, he kicked at the paw hooked into his boot, just as the watch beast reached up with its other limb and sank another claw into the curled top, its strong hind legs scrabbling against the brick. Baldemar's efforts availed him nothing, and he looked down into the herb's yellow eyes and saw its jaws gape in anticipation of the first bite, a long, pointed tongue licking across the rows of teeth like serrated daggers. The sight caused him to give a reflexive jerk of the seized leg. A moment later, he felt the boot slide off his foot, and the watch beast fell into the darkness below. Relieved of the herb's weight, he disregarded the complaints from his finger and calf, as well as the plaintive chirps from the surviving watch beast, and scrambled up the three stories to the roof of the building. Coiling the rope and carrying it with him, he limped to where he had left Thalarian's flying platform, stepped aboard, and said the words that compelled the two indentured imps to lift it into the air and carry him away. The platform's floor pushed against his feet as they climbed into the sky, and Baldemar lowered himself into the plush, high-backed chair and rested his tired limbs on its gilded arms. One of the creatures that powered the platform raised itself enough to peer through the surrounding railing. It was the one with skin like fired clay. The nostrils of its pug nose distended to sniff the scent of blood, and its red and black eyes inspected the wizard's henchmen closely. In a voice that had the creak of stiff leather, it said,
"I do not see the Sword of Destiny."
Baldemar was gingerly pressing his swollen finger, feeling for the break.
"Tend to your own affairs," he said.
"Thalarian will not be pleased."
That was an unfortunate truth. And now that the man had the leisure to consider his situation, he faced the fact that the perils avoided at the beginning of this flight were nothing to what awaited him at the end. They were already far above the rooftops of High Marson, the platform arcing west to where its owner waited in his aerie, overlooking the sparsely settled caravan stop called Corum in the Waste. Thalarian had spent years assembling a unique ensemble. The Sword of Destiny would have completed the set. What the wizard intended to do with the items was unknown. Baldemar thought he would probably construct an invincible champion, to wreak revenge on some adversary. Sorcerers were a tetchy lot, always eager to wreak revenge. The sword's acquisition would have allowed Buldemar to retire from his 30 years of service to the wizard, or so Thalarion had said, though his word was not to be relied upon. But now the Sword of Destiny was not to join Thalarion's collection of magic armor, and Buldemar's employer was not forgiving of failure. Indeed, lately, he had begun to suspect that the Thaumaturge had contracted a condition to which members of the Wizard's Guild were susceptible, creeping figmentia. It was often accompanied by delusions of grandeur and outbursts of misdirected violence. "Change direction," he instructed the Red Imp. "Go due south." The compressed features of its diminutive face drew even closer together.
"The Master awaits," it said.
"What was his last instruction to you?"
"To obey you until you returned to his manse."
"And have we returned there?" The reply was grudging.
"No."
"Then obey me."
"But..."
"Tell me," Buldemar said, "is Thalarion such a wizard as to encourage his underlings to second-guess his wishes, to embroider upon them their own whims and fancies?" A shiver shook the small shoulders.
"He is not such."
"Then take us south, at more speed."
"Still..."
"And do not speak to me again until I require it." The stars above rearranged their positions as the platform turned south. Its velocity increased until the wind of their passage drew tears from Buldemar's eyes. But it was not just the chill of the upper air that made him shiver. Soon they had left the city of Vanderoy, home to Buldemar since he had arrived as a young man to be taken on as a junior henchman to Thalarion the Exemplary, far behind. Now the platform flew south over the forest of Elixtree, until the grand old trees gave way to heathered downs where the villages were few and the sheep many. Soon the rolling land climbed to where it abruptly fell away. Buldemar looked back and saw the alabaster cliffs of Drawn gleaming in the starlight, and knew that he was over the Sundering Sea, its faint, salty reek tainting the wind that blustered against his face. He calculated as best he could their speed, the distance to the sea's farther shore, and the time remaining before Thalarion would begin to wonder why the platform was not landing on the terrace of his mountainside-hugging manse, with his henchmen stepping down to hand him the prize he had been sent to bring. Buldemar had no doubt that the Thaumaturge would be able to reach out to his imps, and the moment he did so, the platform would reverse course and leave him with the choice between returning to Thalarion's wrath, legendary for its depth and inventive display, or leaping to a quick, cold death in the grey waters far below. "But no," he thought. "The imps would bring the platform down beneath me faster than I could fall. They would catch me, then they would make sure I did not try again." He voiced a short word that was out of context, yet appropriate to the gravity of his situation, folded his arms across his chest, and shivered. His agile mind began rapidly considering plans, but just as quickly discarding them. Evading vengeful wizards was a complex task, even for a man with 10 working fingers and both his boots. The dark sky was paler off to his left. Buldemar limped to the portside rail and cupped a hand against the side of his face to shelter his eyes from the wind. The faint light became less pallid, and now he could see a line of grey that gradually resolved into an overcast that stretched from every horizon to every other. Ahead, the cloud layer became darker, and soon he was flying through a cold rain. He leaned against the balustrade and looked down. Darkness still ruled the world below, but after a few more shivers, he saw that the sea was no longer beneath him. He was flying above another forest, this one of dark conifers stretching unbroken as far as he could see, except far off to his right, dim in the distance, where he saw cleared land, and beyond, on the slopes of an eminence, a conglomeration of buildings of various sizes surrounded by a wall, with towers set in it at intervals. Atop the heights sat a more imposing structure of grey stone with its own crenellated walls and a tall keep from which flew a gold and black banner. He began to look around for a clearing to land in. He would send the platform on its way farther south and hope that some southern thaumaturge might seize it for his own. But even as he spotted a distant opening in the forest, the floor beneath him tilted as the platform heeled over and began to head for the castle. He shouted for the imp's attention. "Not that way," he said. "Over there," he added, pointing. But the red imp poked its head up through the balustrade and said,
"We are summoned thence."
"Can you not resist the summons?" Aldemar said. The creature gave an equivocal toss of its head.
"Perhaps, but we really don't care to."
The platform pursued a slanted course over the town, then spiraled down toward a flat-roofed round tower on the castle. A lean old man in a figured robe stood there, his mouth pursed in concentration, and a short length of black wood loose in one veined hand. The imps set the vehicle down softly, as if eager to demonstrate their capabilities, then both scuttled out from under to bob and bow in front of the wizard. Baldemar remained seated in the platform's chair, his posture and face indicative of one who expects an explanation for rude and boisterous behavior. But the man in the robe addressed himself first to the imps.
"Explain yourselves."
This the red one did, with much more prostrating and head-nodding, declaring that they were indentured to Thalarion, the exemplary, grand thaumaturge of the 33rd degree, while the spotted one mimicked every movement to support what was being said.
"And that one?"
the wizard asked, gesturing with the wand toward Baldemar.
"What of him?"
"Don't answer that," Baldemar said, leaping to his feet. "I will speak for myself." But the interrogator made a motion with the wand, and the red imp burst out with,
"Oh, he's a terrible man, and a willful liar. Trust not a word he utters."
"Hmm," said the wizard. He pointed the black wood at Baldemar and said a few syllables, audible only to himself. The man felt a cold shiver enter through the sole of his right foot, swiftly climb his leg, torso, and neck, then exit his left ear after performing what felt like a scouring of his skull with icy water. One hand trembled uncontrollably, and he had difficulty suppressing an intense urge to urinate.
"Now," said the man with the wand, "what's this all about?"
Baldemar had been preparing a tale of misadventure and surprise, in which he featured as a creature of purest innocence. But when he opened his mouth to speak, his tongue rebelled, and he heard himself giving an unadorned version of how his employer, Thalarion the Exemplary, had sent him to recover the Sword of Destiny, in which endeavor he had failed. "Dreading my master's wrath, I fled across the sea on this, his flying platform," he finished. The wizard tugged at his nose, causing Baldemar to fear that another spell would be launched his way. Instead, he was told to accompany the wand wielder down to his workroom. The imps were told to remain where they were.
"I'll send you up some hymetic syrup," said the wizard. "Ooh,"
said the red imp, as the two looked at each other with widened eyes.
"Yum,"
said the spotted one. The wizard's workroom was depressingly familiar. Thalarian's had much the same contents. Shelves crammed with ancient tomes, mostly leather-bound, some of the hides scaly. Glass and metal vessels on a workbench, one of them steaming, though no fire was set beneath it. An oval looking glass hanging on one wall, its surface reflecting nothing that was in this chamber. A small cage suspended on a chain in one corner, containing something that rustled when it moved. The wizard gestured for Boldemar to sit on a stool while he went to pick through a shelf of close-packed books.
"Don't try to run away," he said over his shoulder. "I've been having trouble with my paralysis spell. The fluxions have altered polarity, and the last time I used it..."
He looked up at a large stain on the ceiling.
"Well, let's just say it was an awful mess to clean up."
Boldemar sat on the stool. The wizard sorted through the next shelf down, made a small noise of discovery, and pulled out a heavy volume bound in tattered black hide. He placed it on a chest-high lectern and began to leaf through the parchment pages.
"The Sword of Destiny," you said.
"Yes," said Boldemar. The thaumaturge continued to hunt through the book.
"Why did he want it, this fellow-me-what's-it of yours?"
"Thalarian," said Boldemar. "The exemplary. It was to complete a set of weapons and armor." He named the other items in the ensemble. The shield impenetrable. The helm of sagacity. The breastplate of fortitude. The greaves of indefatigability. As he spoke, the wizard found a page, ran a finger down it, and his face expressed surprise.
"He was going to put these all together?"
"Yes."
"To what purpose?"
"I don't know." The long face turned toward him.
"Speculate."
"Revenge?" said Boldemar.
"He has enemies, this Folderol?"
"Thalarian. He is a thaumaturge. Do they not attract enemies as a lodestone attracts nails?"
"Hmm,"
said the other. He consulted the book again and said,
"But these items do not care for each other. They would not gladly cooperate."
He tugged a thoughtful nose and continued in a musing tone.
"The helmet and the shield might tolerate each other, I suppose. But the greaves would pay no attention to any strategy those two agreed upon. And the sword..."
The wizard made a sound of suppressed mirth.
"Tell me," he said, "your master, he is a practitioner of which school?"
"The Green School," Boldemar said. The wizard closed the book with a clap and a puff of dust.
"Well, there you go,"
he said after a discreet sneeze.
"Green School, and a northerner at that. Say no more."
He shook his head and made a noise that put Boldemar in mind of an elderly spinster contemplating the lusts of the young. The wizard put the book back where he'd found it and favored his visitor with a speculative assessment.
"But you're an interesting specimen. So what to do with you?"
He was stroking his long chin, while the series of expressions on his other features suggested that he was evaluating options without coming to a conclusion, when another man appeared in the doorway, clad in black and gold garments of excellent quality. He was even leaner than the wizard, his face an intricate tracery of fine wrinkles spread over a noble brow, an aristocratically arched blade of a nose, a well-trimmed beard as white as the wings of hair that swept back from his temples, a pair of grey eyes as cold as an ancient winter, surveyed Boldemar as the man said, Is he anything to do with that contraption on the roof?
Yes, Your Grace, said the wizard. He arrived in it.
The aristocrat's brows coalesced in disbelief. He's a thaumaturge.
No, Your Grace, a wizard's henchman who stole his master's conveyance.
The man in the doorway frowned in disapproval, and Baldemar shuddered. The fellow had the aspect of one who enjoyed showing thieves the error of their ways. Indeed, he looked the type to invent new and complex forms of education, the kind from which the only escape is a welcome graduation into death. But then the frown disappeared, to be replaced by the look of a man who has just come upon an unsought but useful item.
Stole from a thaumaturge, you say? That's an accomplishment, isn't it?
The wizard did not share the aristocrat's opinion.
His master is some northern hedge sorcerer. Green school, for Marl's sake.
But the man in the doorway was yielding no ground.
Say as you will, it's an accomplishment.
Understanding dawned in the thaumaturge's face.
Ah,
he said.
I see where Your Grace is going.
Exactly. We could cancel the race.
Indeed.
The thaumaturge now again wore the face of a man who mentally balances abstract issues. After a while, he said,
There is great disaffection this time around. The townspeople and the farmers have lost confidence in your story.
He gestured toward the looking-glass.
I have heard grumblings in many quarters.
The aristocrat's stark face became even starker.
Revolt? He said.
A wave of a wizardly hand.
Some vague mutterings in that vein, but more are talking about packing up and moving to another county. The Duke of Fos Belisse is founding new towns and clearing forest.
The aristocrat grimaced.
Little snot nose, he said.
Actually, Your Grace, he is now in his 50s.
The other man waved away the implication.
I remember his great-great-grandfather. He was just the same. Tried to steal my lead soldiers.
Yes, Your Grace.
The conversation, Baldemar saw, had meandered off and left both participants temporarily stranded. Then the aristocrat seemed to recollect himself. He rubbed his hands against each other, their skin so dry it was like hearing two sheets of parchment frictioned together, and said,
So that's settled. He's accomplished. He'll do.
The wizard considered for but a moment, then said,
I'll need him for a little while first. I think I can get an interesting paper out of him for the Journal of Hermetic Studies. But yes, he'll do.
Do for what? Baldemar said. But the aristocrat had already gone, and the thaumaturge was looking for another book, humming to himself as he ran a finger over their spines. Baldemar thought about easing out the door, then glanced again at the stain on the ceiling, and decided to stay. Over the ensuing few days, Baldemar learned several things. He had landed in the county of Capressica, which was ruled by Duke Albero, he of the papery skin. The wizard was Umbrage, a practitioner of the Blue School. The race the Duke had mentioned was a contest held every 7 years to discover a man of accomplishment who would be sent as an emissary of the Duke to some hazily referenced realm. He would be accompanied by a woman who had bested all others in a test of domestic skills. My companion is a beautiful woman, he asked, when this news was given him by the Duke's majordomo, a man who wore a large panache in his high-crowned black hat and was given to sniffing in disapproval at virtually everything that existence contrived to offer him. "Comeliness is not a factor," the functionary said with a mocking smile. "Certainly not in this case." Voldemar's hopes faded. He had briefly liked the idea of becoming an ambassador, accompanied by some long-necked, pale aristocratic beauty, until the majordomo described the women's champion as a lumbering rural wench who had been a bondsmaid on a dairy farm. "The things that were stuck to her boots defy description," the servant said, adding a sniff of double strength. Umbrage had repaired Buldemar's injuries and given him new clothing and boots. He was a prisoner, but could wander the castle's confines at will, though if he saw Duke Albero at a distance, he should immediately endeavour to make that distance even greater.
"But don't try to leave," said the thaumaturge. "You have opened up an interesting avenue of research, and I will want to question you further. That may not be possible if I have to restrain you with the paralysis spell."
They both glanced at the workroom ceiling and agreed that Buldemar would not venture beyond the castle's walls. However, he did stand on the battlements facing the town and saw the Duke's men-at-arms disassembling a succession of barriers and obstacles strewn along a taped course that followed the curve of the curtain wall. There were narrow beams over mud pits, netting that must be crawled under, some barrels that had to be foot-rolled up a gentle incline, and a series of rotating drums from which protruded stout wooden bars at ankle, chest, and head height, plus some clear patches of turf for sprinting. "It is some sort of obstacle course?" he asked the sentry.
"Yes, you could call it that," said the guard. "The townies and bumpkins don't like it, though. We have to wield whips to keep them running."
"And the winner becomes the Duke's ambassador?" The man-at-arms regarded Buldemar as if his question had revealed him to be a simpleton.
"Sure," he said after a moment. "His Grace's ambassador."
Buldemar would have pressed him for a proper explanation, but at that moment he was summoned by Umbrage. Since the summons consisted of a loud clanging in his head that only lessened when he went in the direction of the summoner and did not cease until he found him, Buldemar did not linger.
"Describe the Sword of Destiny," the thaumaturge said when he arrived breathless in his workroom.
Buldemar did so, mentioning the ornate basket hilt and its inset jewels.
"And you just seized it?"
"Yes."
"Show me your hand."
When the man did so, the wizard examined his palm and the inside flesh of his fingers.
"No burns," he said, apparently to himself.
Umbrage tugged his nose again, then said,
"You said you tricked the guardian herbs into entering another room, then locked them in."
"I did."
"But once you had the sword, they appeared and gave chase."
"Yes."
The how of that had puzzled Buldemar. The lock had been securely set.
"And yet, they did not catch you."
"I ran very quickly."
"But they were herbs," said Umbrage. "Were they decrepit?"
"No. It was a mature dam and her two grown pups."
The wizard made a note on a piece of parchment before him on the workbench.
"You ran onto the roof, and there you left the sword behind."
"It was hampering me, poking me in the leg."
"Just poking? Not slashing, gouging, stabbing?"
"It was still in its scabbard, just stuck through my belt," Buldemar said. "No one was wielding it."
Umbrage's pale hand batted away his last remark as irrelevant.
"Now, this flapdoodle who sent you after it, did he equip you with any thaumaturgical aids?"
"Only the flying platform,
I used my own rope and grapnel, my own lockpicks.
And you're quite sure that the sword did not seek to kill you?
Voldemar showed surprise.
Quite sure.
Another note on the parchment. The wizard rubbed a reflective chin, then raised a finger to launch another question. But at that moment, Duke Albero appeared in the doorway, his face congested with concern.
He needs to go,
he said, flicking a finger in Baldemar's direction.
I may be on the verge of a significant discovery, Ombrage said. This man may be more accomplished than the usual candidate. I need another day, at least.
The Duke's expression brooked no argument. He consulted a timepiece he drew from his garments.
The 7 years end this very afternoon. There can be no extensions.
But,
the wizard began.
No buts.
The Duke was adamant.
No just untils or a moment mores. If he does not go, you know who will arrive. So he goes, and he goes now.
He stepped aside, and the major domo, accompanied by two men-at-arms, entered the workroom. Baldemar found himself once more under restraint. The Duke gestured for them to take him away, but blocked the doorway long enough to tell Ombrage,
"And you will do nothing to interfere with his fulfillment of the requirements."
The thaumaturge looked as if he might have argued, but dipped his head and said,
"I will do nothing to hinder him."
"Good."
Albero once more consulted his timepiece, then said to his major domo,
"You have the medal?"
"Yes, Your Grace."
"Then let's go."
Baldemar was taken to the castle's forecourt, just past the gatehouse. There he stood, his attendants keeping hold of him, while the major domo took from a pouch at his belt a bronze medallion on a chain. Stamped into the metal were the words, "For Merit." He showed it to the Duke, who stood in the doorway of the tower from which they had come, and moved a hand in a gesture that urged speed. The functionary hung the chain around Baldemar's neck. Meanwhile, another pair of guards emerged from a timber outbuilding, leading a plump, young woman in a nondescript gown whose life experiences to this point had developed in her the habits of smiling nervously and wringing her hands. She wore an identical medal. No introductions were made. Instead, the major domo cocked his head toward a waist-high circle of masonry some distance across the courtyard and said,
"Here we go."
"What happens next?" Baldemar said, but no one thought the question worth answering. The stone circle had the look of a well, and when he arrived at it, he peered over and saw a deep shaft descending into darkness. The young woman also took a look into the depths, and her smiling and hand-wringing intensified.
"In you go," said the man in the hat.
"What?" Baldemar adopted an explanatory tone. "I am to be an ambassador. Where is the coach to carry me? My sash of office?" He looked about him, but saw only the woman, the guards and major domo, the Duke, who was agitatedly gesturing, and high in the tower, at the workroom's window, Ombrage, pointing his black wand in their direction and speaking a few syllables. The young woman gave a little start, as if someone had pinched her behind, but then the functionary was pointing toward the dark depths.
"You and she go down," he said. "As you see, we have provided the convenience of a ladder, or we can offer you a more rapid descent."
The woman tried to withdraw, but the guards were practiced at their task. In a moment, her arm was pinned back and she was forced to the brink of the well.
"All right," she said. "I'll climb down."
The functionary considerately helped her over the rim and saw her firmly onto the iron ladder, When she had descended a few rungs, Baldemar accepted the inevitable and took his place above her. Steadily, they made their way down into darkness, while the circle of sky overhead relentlessly shrank. Then it disappeared altogether as the guards slid a wooden cover over the well. Baldemar heard a clank of iron against stone as it was locked into place. He had expected water, but when they came to the foot of the ladder, they were standing on dry rock. It was too dark to see anything, but a cold wind was blowing from somewhere. He said to the woman, "What happens now?" He could not see, but could imagine her nervous smile and busy hands.
"I don't know," she said. "They said it would be a journey to the land of Tir na n'Og, and we would be received by princes and princesses. But..."
She let her voice trail off.
"Tir na n'Og?"
Nothing more was forthcoming, so Baldemar pressed her. "Has anyone ever come back from this paradise?"
"No, but then, who would want to?"
Baldemar realized he wasn't dealing with the realm's most intelligent specimen of womanhood. "Did you have to run an obstacle race?" he said.
"No, that's just for the boys. We have our own competition of women's skills: sewing, milking a cow, baking bread, plucking a chicken."
"And you won?"
"I was surprised," she said. "There were better seamstresses and bakers in the contest, yet somehow they all faltered, and it was I who received the accolade."
"Which is at the bottom of a dry well." She said nothing, but he could hear the faint sound of her hands comforting each other. "Stay here," Baldemar said. "I'll explore a little." He felt his way around the wall until he found a gap, then he got down on hands and knees to cross it until the wall resumed again. While he crawled, he was chilled by a river of cold air. He stood up and said, "Say something."
"What?"
Her voice came from the darkness. He oriented himself and found his way back to her side. "There's a tunnel," he said. Her voice came quavering.
"Where does it go?"
He told her he did not know and had no desire to find out. They stood in the darkness and felt the wind. The flow of air must mean that the tunnel connected with the outside world, but he had no desire to grope his way through blackness in which anything might lurk. Time passed. The woman introduced herself as Anolia. Baldemar gave her his name. They sat on the rock, backs against the wall on either side of the ladder. After a time, Baldemar let his mind wander and found himself thinking about the wizard's questions, about the Sword of Destiny. Anolia's voice brought him back to the here and now.
"I smell something."
His head came up and now he caught it too, a sour odor, almost sulphurous, with a nose-tickling, peppery overtone that made him want to sneeze. "It's coming from the tunnel," he said. A moment later, he added, "There's a light." They stood up, backs against the wall. Baldemar missed his knife, which was still in his boot, far away to the north. Then he found himself missing the sword. The tunnel was long and the light was far down it. It did not flicker like a flame, nor throw a beam like a mirror-backed lantern. He saw a shapeless yellow glow that gradually resolved into a sphere with a flattened bottom, the shape of the tunnel. The closer it came, the stronger grew the taint of brimstone with a strong underlay of putrefaction. He felt motion beside him and realized that the woman was trying to fit herself between him and the wall. "Stop that," he said, but she did not.
"I'm frightened," she said.
So was Baldemar. There was no point dwelling on it. He couldn't quite bring himself to try to hide behind her, so he let her peep over his shoulder as the light came nearer. When it was 100 paces away, he saw that there was something within the sphere. At 50 paces, he could almost make out what it was. At 30, he could see it clearly and wished he did not have to. The stench became the olfactory equivalent of deafening. A moment later, the yellow glow filled the mouth of the tunnel and the bottom of the well. There was neither torch nor lantern. The light somehow came sourcelessly from the creature before him. It regarded them from several eyes. Then an orifice that resembled no mouth that Buldemar had ever seen spoke in a voice that was somewhere between a hiss and a gobble.
"Well, here we are again."
"It is the first time for us," said Buldemar. He felt Enolia's head nodding against his shoulder in strident agreement.
"I don't suppose," said the demon.
The man couldn't think of another word that did the thing justice.
"That you bring me a message from Duke Albaro. Something along the lines of, 'I'm ready, take me.'"
Buldemar said that no message had been vouchsafed to him, and felt the woman's nose rub his shoulder as she signaled the same was true for her. "But," he added, "I'm willing to climb the ladder and ask for one if you can give me some help with the lid up there." The demon made a sound that might have been a sigh, if a sigh could sound that horrible.
"We might as well get on with it then," it said.
"With what?" Despite the almost unbreathable air, Buldemar felt a strong urge to extend this part of the encounter, rather than discover just what "get on with it" might entail.
"The usual."
"And what is the usual?" The demon focused all of its eyes on the man. Buldemar felt an uncomfortable pressure in his skull and a terrible itching of his palms and soles, but he bore the sensations as best he could while maintaining an expression of polite interest. Part of the glowing creature moved and settled. Buldemar thought he might just have witnessed how a demon shrugged.
"Very well," it said. "Duke Albaro made one of those agreements I'm sure you've heard about. Wealth, power, health, longevity, and so on, until he should grow weary of the eternal sameness of existence. Meanwhile, I have to hang about and do his bidding."
"He seems to have fended off the weariness," Buldemar said. "Indeed, he looks capable of doing so indefinitely."
"Hence the escape clause," said the demon. "Every 7th year, he must send me a man and a woman of accomplishment. I ask them 3 riddles. If they can answer them, I go up and collect the Duke and take him back with me."
"And if they can't?" Again, the complex set of strange motions.
"I take the messengers."
"By any chance, would you take them to a paradise?"
"No, not a paradise,"
was the answer.
"Certainly not for them. Indeed, I find it rather confining myself. I would much prefer to collect the Duke and go home."
"Oh," said Buldemar. The gibbering from behind him increased, but he forced himself to focus his mind and said, "What is the first riddle?" The demon said,
"What walks on 4 legs in the morning, on 2 at noon, and 3 in the evening?"
"Seriously?" said Buldemar.
You can't answer.
Another demonic sigh. A limb festooned with hooks and grapples reached for him. Of course I can answer, said Baldemar. Everybody knows that one. The arm or leg, or whatever it was, withdrew into the gloom.
None of the Duke's messengers has ever answered it correctly,
the creature said. Baldemar realized that the 7 yearly contests were not intended to determine who among the Duke's subjects were the most learned. They were instead tests of gullibility. The answer, he said, is man. As an infant, he crawls on all fours. That is the morning of his life. In maturity, his noon, he walks on his own 2 feet. And in the evening, which is his dotage, he relies on a cane. All the demon's eyes again concentrated their gazes upon the man, and again he had to resist the urge to rub itchy palms and soles together. It's hard for me to think when you do that, he said. The creature sent most of its eyes looking in other directions.
I was just surprised, it said. No one has got it right before.
The accomplishments of the Duke's previous messengers, said Baldemar, were not in the arena of intellect.
I should have specified scholars, the demon said. But now I'm encouraged. Here is the second conundrum. Do take your time.
The man thought that the contortion of its facial parts might approximate a smile. Shivering, he looked away and listened to the riddle.
There are 2 sisters. Each gives birth and death to the other. What are they?
The conundrum rang a faint chime in the back of his mind, but he could not quite close a mental grip upon it. He said to Anolia, Do you know it?
No, it makes no sense, she said.
She began to snuffle against his shoulder.
Poor me, I shall never see another dawn. Oh, woe!
Dawn, that's it, Baldemar said. The sisters are night and day. Each gives birth to the other. Each ends the life of the other.
Very good, said the demon. Very, very good.
The man could not be sure, but beneath the pure horror of its hideous voice and writhing facial parts, it sounded actually pleased.
And now, the last and simplest.
It paused portentously, then said,
What do I have in my hand?
Instinctively, Baldemar looked at the limb that had reached for him, then at another that arched up and over what he thought might be the demon's head if it had a neck, finally at a third appendage that more or less curled at its more or less feet. Is there a clue? He said.
I wish there could be, said the demon. I have long wanted to leave here and install the Duke in my collection.
Let me think.
Yes, do.
The first riddle had been easy. The second had come courtesy of a prompt from the woman. He now spoke to her over his shoulder. Anything? Her voice was a whisper.
Nothing.
And he could feel she had gone back to wringing her hands. Can you repeat the question? He said.
What is in my hand?
Which hand?
No clues, said the demon. Oh, dear. Does this mean you're falling at the last jump?
Give me a minute. Voldemar was mentally cudgeling his brain. What would a demon have in its hand? What would this particular demon have in its particular hand? For some reason, or no reason at all, he wanted to blurt out, "A piece of cake." The young woman began to blub, her tears and nasal flows wetting his shirt.
"It's not fair," she said. "It doesn't even have a hand."
A sensation came upon Voldemar, like a cooling flow of water on a searing summer day. "Nothing," he told the demon. "You have nothing in your hand because you don't have a hand, just a kind of paw and a crabby claw thing, and," he couldn't find the words, "and whatever that other thing is. But I know it's not a hand." There was a silence at the bottom of the well, broken only by the woman's stifled sobs. Then the yellow glow around the demon deepened to gold and became tinged with red around the edges.
"Goodbye,"
it said, then swept up the shaft of the well at great speed, taking most of its stench with it. Voldemar looked up and saw the timber lid fly apart into splinters. He pulled Anolia into the tunnel as a rain of sharp wood briefly fell, then said, "Come on." He threw himself at the ladder and climbed with as much alacrity as his still trembling legs could deliver. The young woman matched him step for step. When they climbed over the rim of the well, it was early evening. He saw the flying platform, far off in the distance, framed against the dying light. From the castle came shouts and screams, the clatter of boots on stone flags. In the nearby stables, hooves were pounding against stalls. Then, from on high, came one great cry of despair. "Get back," he warned the woman, as a pulsing sphere of red light appeared at the top of the keep, leapt into the air, and arrowed down toward the well. It paused above the opening, and Voldemar had a glimpse of the Duke, wrapped in what might have been a tentacle, bedecked with curved thorns, the circles of his eyes and mouth forming a perfect isosceles triangle. He was making sounds that were not quite words. The demon had all of its eyes trained on the new addition to its collection, but it let one stray toward the man.
"He who made me ordained that gratitude may never be part of my nature," it said. "But I am required to seek equipoise."
Voldemar said, "I am not prepared to make a bargain with you. No offense meant."
"None taken," said the demon. "But I cannot be obligated, and I find that I am, to both of you. You may each ask a service of me at no further charge."
Voldemar took this statement and turned it over to examine it from several angles, demons being what they were. But the woman said, "I would like a nice farm with good crop fields and healthy livestock, a warm, well-furnished house, with a pump right in the kitchen."
"Done," said the fiend. "It used to belong to the Kazakian family."
"I was their servant," she said. "They were always cruel to me, said I was not good enough to clean their muddy boots. The girls pull my hair, and the boys clutch me in private places."
"I know," said the fiend.
Then, as an aside to Voldemar, it added,
"Equipoise, as I said."
To Anolia, it said,
"The Kazakians are now your indentured servants."
A claw handed her several scrolls and a cane fashioned from black spiraled wood.
"Here are all the necessary documents, and a stout stick to beat them with."
The woman took them and clasped them to her bosom. A smile briefly softened her features before they assumed an aspect of determination. "I have to go now," she said, and left without further ceremony. Baldemar had finished his examination of the demon's offer. "Free of charge," he said. "No comebacks."
"No comebacks. But hurry up and decide. I am eager to introduce Duke Albaro to his new circumstances."
"Can we leave it open? Can I call you when I have need?"
"If it is not too long," said the demon. "I experience obligation as a nagging itch. When you know what you want, say the name Azeroth, and I shall arrive forthwith."
Then it disappeared down the well with the gibbering addition to its collection. The castle was empty of people, though filled with the odor the demon had left behind. Baldemar breathed through his mouth and found it bearable. He had not gone far before he came upon the majordomo's hat, the man's head still in it. From a room dedicated to trunks and lidded baskets, he took a capacious satchel. In the duke's quarters, he changed into richer garments, then examined the coffers and cupboards, choosing items that were valuable yet sturdy, precious metals and gems mostly, along with as much weight in gold coins as he could carry. He also filled a purse with silver bits and bronze asses for incidentals. The coins all bore the likeness of the duke. Baldemar studied the aquiline profile on one, then turned it to see the obverse. It showed a date from a previous century and Albaro's motto in an extinct tongue. "Miro, odal, miro." Baldemar thought back to his school days and found he could translate it. "Mine. All mine," he said. He dropped the coin into the purse, put the purse in the satchel, and patted its comforting bulk. Then he smiled, the exact smile as the woman had, before she set off. The black horse the duke had ridden was in its stall, half maddened by the smell of demon. But Baldemar was an experienced horse handler, and soon calmed the beast. He saddled and bridled it with the duke's own gold-chased tack and affixed the satchel securely behind. He walked it out into the courtyard, still clucking and cooing to comfort it, and saw that some of the men-at-arms had abandoned their weapons when the fiend arrived. He picked up a serviceable sword and, since he was riding, a long-shafted lance. It had a black and gold pennant that he tore off. The animal's iron shoes beat solid notes on the drawbridge as it carried Baldemar out of the castle. The fortifications' surrounds were empty, and he suspected that he would find the town similarly deserted. Demons had that effect. "Now," he said to himself, "I'll ride to the land's edge and take passage on a ship sailing north. I'll buy myself a house in one of the seven cities of the sea and invest in the fiduciary pool. Maybe I'll get a boat and take up fishing." He touched his heels to the black sides and the horse began to canter toward the town. Just then, a voice from above him said,
"There you are."
Baldemar looked up. The flying platform was just overhead, Umbrage leaning on the balustrade. It settled to the turf and the wizard said,
"Come aboard. We have to go."
The man was tempted to urge the horse to a gallop, but the thaumaturge was tapping the palm of one hand with the wand. He climbed aboard and the flying platform turned north. Past the town, he looked down and saw Enolia marching along a lane that led to a capacious stone farmhouse. She paused to roll up her sleeves, then used her stick to take a few practice swipes at the weeds that grew beside the track, before resuming her methodical progress toward the house. When the platform shadow passed over her, she did not look up.
The thing is, the thaumaturge said, you really ought to be dead.
They were flying north over the sundering sea at an even faster speed than Buldemar had come south. Umbrage had fed the imps well on hymetic syrup and conjured an invisible shield to protect him and Buldemar from the shrieking wind of their passage. The wizard's henchman had been watching the waves ripple the surface of the sea. Now he turned to the thaumaturge. The demon would have given me a fate worse than death, he said. He would have taken Anolia and me for playthings.
I'm not talking about the demon. I'm talking about the Sword of Destiny. It is known to be very touchy about being touched.
He grinned at his play on words, but Buldemar bored in on the substance of his remark. You're saying the sword has a will of its own?
A will and a history of seeing that will turned into ways and means, if you get what I'm saying.
Buldemar said, so Thalarion was sending me to be killed? His disaffection for his employer plumbed new depths.
I doubt that, said Umbrage. He simply didn't know what he was getting into, or, more properly, getting you into. But it's clear from my researches that the moment your hand touched the sword, you should have found yourself looking at a charred stump somewhere between your wrist and elbow.
Buldemar shuddered, but the thaumaturge went on, oblivious to his distress.
Instead, the sword merely freed the herbs you had sequestered so that they could chase you away. Even then, it did not allow them to catch you, as they certainly should have. The man has not yet been born who can outrun an herb, especially upstairs.
Buldemar forced from his mind the image of what would have happened if the beasts had caught him.
Then, instead of hacking off a leg, it hampered you just enough to make you leave it behind.
So it didn't want to kill me, yet it didn't want me to take it away. Umbrage thoughtfully tugged his nose, then pointed a conclusive finger at Buldemar.
It did not want you to take it to this fallow brain who sent you, he said. But I think we have to deduce that it didn't mind your touch.
Buldemar turned back to the sea. I am confused, he said.
As you ought to be. You're probably not used to thinking of yourself as a man of destiny.
Indeed, I am not.
Well, you'd better get used to it. Once it makes up its mind, the sword can be quite adamant.
Umbrage went on to describe the sword's history and attributes. Forged on some other plane of existence, its exact circumstances of origin were now completely forgotten. On the plane where it was created, it probably had some other shape and function altogether, but here on the third plane, it presented as an invincible weapon. Yet it was more than that. It had the inclination sometimes to single out
persons of interest.
That was the sword's own term, and assist them to become grand figures of the age.
Its own term, Buldemar said. It speaks.
When it cares to, said the wizard. But to continue, persons possessed of overweening ambition will seek out the sword and grasp its hilt. Most of them meet with a swift and decisive end of all their dreams. It is not a forgiving entity, and hates to be harassed. But occasionally it picks out some seeming non-entity and raises him to heights of glory. Some have taken that as a sign the sword possesses a sense of
humor. Amazing, said Buldemar. You have never heard of any of this?
My education was largely informal and centered on acquiring practical skills. Said the thaumaturge, and spent some time studying Buldemar, after which he said,
You don't show any signs of being a candidate for glory, but then again, you might be one of those seeming non-entities.
Buldemar did not know whether to be insulted or pleased. Situations involving thaumaturges and magical weapons were often hard to read.
Well, we'll just have to see,
Umbridge said. The sun had set long before they crossed the southern downs and the forest of Elixtri. Soon the lights of Vanderoy showed themselves, strung atop a long ridge and its lower slopes. Buldemar offered to direct Umbridge to the building where the sword resided, but the wizard waved the proposal away.
I can find it, he said. To one of my abilities, it emits the equivalent of a blinding light and an ear-splitting noise.
He made a small sound of contempt and added,
Your employer, the great Fulbean, probably managed to catch a faint glow and a fading whisper.
They crossed the city wall and began to spiral down toward the rooftop Buldemar remembered so well. I suppose, he said, that's not really a building at all.
Of course it is, said Umbridge. But it is an edifice unremarked by even its neighbours, who pass by daily with never a thought as to what lies within. Even the city's tax collectors will overlook it.
The sword's doing, the man said.
As I said, it prefers not to be harassed.
The roof was in darkness, but as they descended closer, Buldemar saw motion on its flat surface. Look, he said. The wizard peered, then made a gesture and muttered something. Immediately, the top of the building was bathed in bright light, revealing that someone was bent over the trapdoor, tugging at it with both hands.
Oh my, said Umbridge, truly a skimpwit of the first water.
The figure looked up, shading its eyes against the light, and Buldemar saw that the skimpwit was Thalarion, clad in the greaves of indefatigability, the breastplate of fortitude, and the helmet of sagacity. The shield impenetrable lay on the rooftop beside him, but now he snatched it up and slipped an arm through it, while his other hand produced a wand tipped with a large, faceted emerald. Buldemar knew that wand well. He flinched in anticipation. But Umbridge said,
Oh, really?
And made a shooing gesture with the backs of his fingers. The shield glowed briefly as it was thrust back against Thalarion, who stumbled backward and ended up on his rump. Umbridge had the imps bring the platform to a gentle landing. He opened the gate in the balustrade and stepped down onto the rooftop. Buldemar followed, being careful to keep the southern thaumaturge between him and his employer. But not careful enough, because now Thalarion laboriously rose to his feet, leaning on the shield, and his gaze locked on his missing henchman. His unappetizing features twisted in rage.
Aha! Miscreant, faithless turd, slack ass!
He had dropped his emerald-tipped wand. Now he stooped and took it up, and said,
Receive your just punishment.
I would not do that here, said Umbridge. The sword might not like it.
Thalarion focused on Umbridge just long enough for outrage to expand his eyes and mouth. Then all his features contracted and his gaze again bored into his lackey.
You told,
he cried. The sword was my great secret, and you told this...
Umbridge the erudite, said the object of his inarticulacy. Blue school, 98th degree, and I advise you to lower that thing you probably think of as a wand before something truly awful happens to you.
Valerian looked from henchman to wizard, then back and forth several times. His mouth made sounds that were neither words nor incantations, and spittle appeared on his lips. Finally, he emitted a noise that came straight out of his lower throat and pointed the wand at Buldemar. He spoke a portentous syllable, and the instrument's tip glowed a baleful green. A vindictive smile spread across his lips, and he opened his mouth to speak again. At the moment, the trap door behind him flew open and struck the rooftop with a heavy slam. Light shot up from a great brightness within the stairwell, and, as Thalarion turned to see, the head, neck, and then the shoulders of a young herb serenely emerged from the glowing rectangle. Baldemar's employer made another wordless sound, this one expressive of surprise and horror. He pointed his wand at the beast that, continuing its rise from the stairwell, now showed its clawed hands, which clutched the sword of destiny. At this juncture, Thalarion made two decisions. One wise, one not. The wise move was to drop his wand. The unwise choice was to assume that the herb was bringing him the sword, and that he ought to reach for it. His grasping fingers made contact with the scabbard. Another blast of light illuminated the rooftop, though this one entirely conformed to the shape of Thalarion, the exemplary. His person was limned by a glare so bright that his body seemed to be a black silhouette at its center. Then the light faded, and the seeming became the reality. Where the wizard had been, there now stood a figure of deepest black, dull and unreflective. It remained standing just long enough for the shape to be recognized and for its armor and shield to fall away with a clatter. Then the silhouette fell apart into granules of coarse grit that cascaded down to become a cone of Stygian cinder. Scarcely had it formed a conical shape before its mass spread out under its own weight to lie as a circular mat of black sand, sand that crunched under the clawed feet of the herb as, still clutching the sword, it stepped out of the trap door and approached Buldemar. He whirled to leap onto the flying platform, only to find that it was now high above him and moving off, with Umbridge leaning over the balustrade to observe the scene he had left. A glance to one side told Buldemar that the rope and grapnel he had left on the adjacent building were no longer there. He turned back and saw the beast coming on at a steady pace, the sword now held in its paws so that the jewel-bedecked hilt offered itself to him. Buldemar experienced a moment of sharp mental clarity. There were two outcomes to accepting the herb's offer. In one, he would be instantly and probably painfully converted into black grit, as Thalarion had been. In the other, he would rise as a man of destiny to carve out a kingdom or an empire and rule by whim and fiat. The momentary appeal of the latter prospect swiftly faded as he recalled the ruler of the county of Capressica, Duke Albero.
I don't want that life, he heard his inner voice saying. He remembered his plan to find a nice house in one of the seven cities of the sea and a boat to fish from. That option, however, did not seem to be available at this moment. But the thought of the parchment-skinned duke brought up another possibility, a desperate gamble fit for a desperate situation. As the sword's hilt almost touched his fingers, Buldemar said, Azarath! He was immediately enveloped in a hideous odor and yet another bright light. Between him and the herb, which had leapt back, stood the repellent form of the demon.
"What can I do for you?"
it said. Voldemar pointed, and the fiend turned to regard the beast and what it held in its claws. All of its eyes focused on the sword, and a kind of ripple went through its being that the man could only interpret as an expression of delight.
"There you are,"
said the demon, reaching out and taking the sword from the herb, which promptly fainted from terror. The fiend folded the weapon in two of its limbs, clutching it to what might have been its torso. It seemed to Voldemar that the sword also shivered in pleasure.
"I thought I'd lost you forever,"
Azeroth said.
"What have you been up to all this time?"
The fiend stood still, attentively listening to whatever the sword was telling it. Finally, it stroked the scabbard and said,
"Well, never mind. That's all over now. We'll go home, and it will be as if none of this ever happened. I've got a nice, fresh duke for us to play with."
It became aware of Voldemar again, and the man thought he was seeing a demonic frown.
"It seems," the creature said, "that I am even more in your debt."
Its body shook like thorned jelly.
"The itch is quite uncomfortable."
Voldemar did not hesitate. "Can you arrange for me to have," he said, "a nice house in Galatherian, overlooking the sundering sea, with a sturdy boat to go fishing in, and perhaps a satchel of gold and jewels?"
"Done,"
said Azeroth. Two scrolls appeared at the man's feet.
"Those are the deed and the boat registration. You'll find the satchel in the library. Shall I transport you there now?"
"No, thank you. I think the wizard will carry me." But Azeroth's attention had returned to the Sword of Destiny.
"You arranged all this," it said, "just to find me again. What a smart little woozums you are."
It stroked the scabbard again, making cooing noises, then disappeared. The flying platform touched down. Umbridge offered no apology for deserting Voldemar, who expected none. If their positions had been reversed, he would have made the same hasty exit. The wizard did enthuse about the events he had witnessed, chortling and saying,
"I feel a wonderful scholarly paper coming on."
"It seems," Voldemar told the wizard, stepping over the recumbent herb to where Thalarion's ashes were scattering in the wind, "that I have acquired a few pieces of magical armor. Would you care to purchase them? For scholarly purposes, of course." A brief haggle followed, concluded to both participants' mutual satisfaction. A purse was conjured into existence and passed over. Then Voldemar helped the wizard gather the items and load them aboard the platform. Umbridge also swept up some of the grit that had been Thalarion the Exemplary and stowed it in a brass cylinder with a tightly fitting lid.
"You never know," he said.
Meanwhile, Voldemar picked up his scrolls and read the address on one of them. "Will you be passing near the city of Galatherian?" he asked Umbridge.
"I can do.
I would appreciate a ride." The wizard shrugged.
"If you'll fill in a few more details about your association with the demon, I mean to make the editor of Hermetic Studies clap for joy."
"Done," said Voldemar. As they flew over the city, Umbridge observed, in a carefully idle tone,
"Even a scholarly thaumaturge can always use a good henchman."
"I was never a good henchman," Voldemar said. "Could never manage the required depth of self-abnegation.
I was not even a very good thief. But I think I just might make a passable fisherman.
Kate Elliott. Kate Elliott is the author of 26 fantasy and science fiction novels, including her New York Times best-selling YA fantasy, Court of Fives, and its sequels, Poisoned Blade and Buried Heart. Her most recent epic fantasy is Black Wolves, winner of the Artie Award for Best Epic Fantasy of 2015. She's also written the alt-history Spiritwalker trilogy, Cold Magic, Cold Fire, Cold Steel, an Afro-Celtic post-Roman gas lamp fantasy adventure with well-dressed men, badass women, and lawyer dinosaurs. Other series include the Crossroads trilogy, the seven-volume Crown of Stars epic fantasy, the science fiction Novels of the Geron, and a short fiction collection, The Very Best of Kate Elliott. Her novels have been finalists for the Nebula, World Fantasy, and Norton Awards. Under her real name of Elise A. Rasmussen, she's written the novels The Labyrinth Gate, A Passage of Stars, Revolution's Shore, and The Price of Ransom. Born in Iowa and raised in farm country in Oregon, she currently lives in Hawaii, where she paddles outrigger canoes for fun and exercise. You can find her on Twitter at Kate Elliott SFF. Here she introduces us to the self-proclaimed handsome man, Apollo Crowe, who turns out to be a lot more, and a lot stranger, than merely someone with a pretty face.
"I am a handsome man," said Apollo Crowe. Kate Elliott. "I am a handsome man," said Apollo Crowe, fixing the Emperor of Rome with a look that dared that august ruler to disagree. "If your desire is to have a woman kidnapped without alerting her confederates until it is too late to rescue her, look no further. My skills are subterfuge, tracking down people who don't wish to be found, and an ability to lie with a straight face. I am also an exceptionally skilled swordsman." The Emperor set chin upon hand with thoughtful consideration, a pose suited to the stage, as he was well aware. "I was warned you always lie about something." "Alas, so I do. It is a curse." His charming smile made a witticism of the remark. "I am sure to a ruffian like you, such a claim seems an amusing challenge. However, your situation is easy enough for a man such as me to expose. We'll start by a process of elimination. Are you truly an exceptionally skilled swordsman? I will duel any among your soldiers, or two or three at once. Bring them forth." The Emperor flicked up his fingers, straightening. "Will you duel me?" One eyebrow only Apollo Crowe raised, a neat trick many an opponent had admired to their cost. "It seems dishonorable, considering your age." The Emperor extended his right hand. An attendant guardsman settled a steel blade into the imperial fingers. He rose, took three steps down from the dais onto the marble floor of the audience chamber, and indicated that he was ready to begin. Naturally, Apollo Crowe wore a hip-length black cape, of the sort that swirls dashingly with any swift movement. He spun a full circle, the fabric floating like a whirl of shadow. When he again faced the Emperor, he held his blade in his right hand, as if it had appeared there by magic rather than sleight of hand. The Emperor shifted stance, taking his sword into his left hand. Apollo Crowe smiled and did the same. Light pouring from high-arched windows framed their shapes to dazzling effect, as uniformed soldiers and gaudily robed officials admired the show. "What is your fee?" A probing flurry by the Emperor, easily parried by Apollo Crowe. "That depends upon the distance to be travelled and the circumstances under which I must put myself at risk." They circled. "The woman is a beauty, so that part of the job is no risk." "What one man calls beauty, another may find trifling, But that you call her a beauty tells me a good deal. Is she a woman who spurned you, the very emperor of shrunken Rome? The emperor laughed. Quite the opposite, if you must know. Or at least so you feel obliged to claim. Crow essayed a thrust, and the emperor of all Rome and its few remaining provinces turned it aside. I need affect no lies, Crow. I am hiring you to do a job and ascertaining whether you can succeed. The woman is secondary to my interest. I need her sketchbook, which she carries with her everywhere. She is herself exceptionally well guarded, and her movements well concealed by her many allies. The emperor feinted left, then rapidly attacked right. Apollo Crow replied with a vicious riposte. Of what possible use can a sketchbook be to you? Are there compromising images that you seek to recover and burn? A flurry of parries and thrust rang through the hall. Both stymied, they broke apart. These are tedious attempts at provocation, said the emperor, scarcely out of breath. Can you manage it? It seems a simple enough job. Where do I start? My agents report there will be a secret meeting in the town of Nicaea, a gathering of criminals and malcontents who harbor revolutionary sentiments. We don't know in which disreputable tavern it will take place. They change their meeting places every week. In any case, even if we did know, were my soldiers to appear in force, it would scare her off. Any violence done at the gathering will merely strengthen their querulous voices. So this is where you come in, Crow. Why, a seditious gathering with one foot into the empire itself. No wonder you are eager to crush this assembly before it can send its roots into Roman soil. Yet what has a beautiful woman to do with such masculine pursuits as revolution? The emperor flashed an annoyed look toward a tapestry on the wall, whose bright colors and bold design depicted his famous Amazon regiment striding into battle. As with the strike of an agitated viper, he pressed a bold attack straight at the other man. The ring of their blades striking and sliding, the scuff and stamp of their feet, and the movements of their bodies as they sought each to gain the upper hand, were for a time the only dance in the chamber. The emperor pressed with his greater height and weight, while Apollo Crow answered with a speed and precision that made him seem to almost float above the ground. At length they disengaged, and the emperor stepped back to indicate the bout had ended. You disappoint me with your conventional thinking. That you are a rejected lover, anxious to avenge yourself on an arrogant woman by stealing from her a personal item that is precious to her? A smile fluttered and faded. That women cannot foment revolution. Indeed, they are the more dangerous once roused. I had thought one such as you, who makes a living outside of the law, would not indulge in too much of convention. One such as me? What sort of one is that? Among other things, a person who makes a living outside of the law. The emperor shook his head. But I am finished dueling with you. Perhaps I can find a better person for the work. You cannot. If you have come to me, it means you have failed in your previous attempts to obtain the sketchbook. True enough, agreed the emperor with a gracious nod. At a gesture from the ruler, an official walked forward and handed a substantial pouch of coins to Apollo Crow. The man weighed them without opening the pouch. I know what you are lying about, added the emperor. Do you, indeed? So we shall discover. With a decisive nod, the emperor indicated the doors, which were promptly opened by waiting attendants. Apollo Crow smiled. He had a winning smile, a seductive smile, a handsome smile, and he knew it. With a flourish made into a mocking bob of a bow, he took his leave of the imperial palace. Nicaea was a port town, seething with travelers, sailors, and merchants, a volatile and lucrative brew spiced with rumor, poverty, and discontented plebeians, whose ears itched the more fiercely as more promises of suffrage were whispered into them. The haunts where radical sentiments pooled like wraiths awaiting release on Hallows' Eve were many, and Apollo Crowe only one man, with one pair of legs. Yet he had other means of gathering intelligence. A week after he arrived, a crow fluttered to land on the open windowsill of the room at the inn where he was staying. Since he hated being alone, he always found a way to have company. The woman in his bed raised herself up on an elbow, her beautiful eyes opening wide as the crow bobbed a greeting.
"What dreadful omen is this?"
she gasped. "You think like a Celt," he said, as he slipped from under the covers. He grabbed a bit of bread off a platter on the sideboard and went to the window to offer it to the bird. "The crow is sacred to my namesake, the Hellene god." The bird snapped up the bread, then caught for so long a stretch that the woman laughed.
"Is it thanking you for the meal or boring you with a complaint?"
"Not at all. Just giving me a welcome scrap of information in exchange."
"What an amusing tale-teller you are. Crows would make magnificent conspirators and agents if only they could talk and spy."
Her voice turned coaxing.
"You standing there naked has quite obliterated all thoughts of omens, battlefields, and carrion crows from my mind. I would take another welcome scrap if you have a mind to come back to bed, for I certainly have no complaints."
"I am compliant in all things that harmonize with my wishes," he assured her truthfully, turning away from the window. "Are you acquainted with a tavern called the Four Abreast?"
"By rumor only, not from setting foot in it myself. You wouldn't want to go there."
"Why not?"
"It's in a very poor part of town, frequented by sailors, washerwomen, and cutthroats."
She beckoned him closer with a pretty frown.
"But I see from your expression you are determined to get yourself killed in that dreadful district. So be it. Come over here so I don't waste this chance while you are still among the living."
Later he made his way amid the dregs of twilight down a dismal avenue lined with shuttered shops on the trail of the Four Abreast. Dark, empty streets made him melancholy, pining for the open land he had once called home. Ahead, a man pushed a cart of refuse while whistling a cheerful melody that lightened the lonely night. He quickened his pace to catch up, and just as he was about to make a friendly remark, the carter halted next to a dank alley. A pair of ragged children crept out of the darkness.
"Go ahead, but be quick,"
murmured the carter. The children pawed through the stench-ridden garbage for anything they might use, eat, or sell. "There's a coin in it for each of you if you can lead me to the Four Abreast," Apollo Crowe said to the children. The carter slapped away their reaching hands.
"Don't go walking with strange men."
"I meant no harm. Can you tell me, Maester? I know I'm bound for the streets below Castle Hill, but by what means may I recognize the tavern?"
"Why do you want to know?"
"I've served a cruel master and escaped. It seems right to see what I can do to help others who may wish for a different way of life." The carter grunted, not entirely convinced. "For your trouble, then." Apollo Crowe tossed a coin to each child, pressed a third into the man's hand, and walked away.
"Juniper wards the entrance," the carter called after him. "That's all I'll say."
The neighborhood crowded up against the flanks of Castle Hill, straight streets collapsing into a confusing web of cramped lanes. The night lamps that illuminated the harbor walk and main avenues were absent. Gloom spilled like an incoming tide, turning every doorway and alley into a pool of shadows. A figure detached itself from a wall, swinging a club. Apollo Crowe made a great drama of drawing his sword, and the shape thought better of attacking him and slid away into the night. The harsh laughter of women drew him to a dilapidated gate, framed by wreaths of strong-smelling juniper beneath candle lanterns, two on each side. Because it was set ajar, he pushed on it, then realized it was stuck. Anyone going in would have to squeeze through, making them easy prey to an ambush. He cocked his head to one side, listening, and identified two heartbeats waiting beyond. Sheathing the sword, he stepped sideways, back to the wall, and found himself in a hazy courtyard redolent of fish being smoked. A pair of burly guards shined a light on him. They hadn't even gotten out their swords.
"You're a looker, and that's for sure," said one.
He looked at his companion as if they were both about to burst out laughing.
"But there isn't no one hereabouts who can afford the likes of you, if it's yourself that you're selling. No fancy personages up to your scratch of the type you must be accustomed to."
He tossed them each a coin. "I've a fancy to try the brew, that's all. I hear that late at night the tap flows with speeches and songs of a sort that interest me."
"At your own risk,"
they waved him on. Beyond the reek of the smokehouses lay the more pleasant aroma of a stable, and beyond it, another courtyard overlooked by a portico in the Roman style, supported by old stone pillars. The building that rose up against the ancient columns was modern, built of wood. Lamps shone within to illuminate people seated in a spacious common room, their figures distorted by thick window glass. A pair of fiddles unfurled a dancing tune into the air, two voices weaving around each other as people stamped along to the rhythm. He made a cautious entrance to find himself in the cheerful clamor of a tavern common room, divided in the Kena'ani fashion, with a rope fence down the middle, so men and women sat separately. He took a step toward the right, corrected himself, and went to sit on the men's side. A blond lad of Celtic fairness and stern Roman disposition brought him a mug of the house beer, so golden it might have been brewed from sunlight. He struck up a conversation with a group of local men, whose calloused hands and sun-weathered faces proclaimed them dockhands.
"Where'd you hail from?"
they asked him.
"What ship did you come